back on Downtown. Our next guest on the program is an artist, writer, and actor. You've seen her in films like As Good As It Gets, City Slickers, Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive, television shows like Herman's Head, The Mindy Project, and Mom. But you know her best for her work for more than three decades as the voice of Lisa Simpson. We had a wonderful time yesterday catching up with the delightful Yardley Smith. So much to talk about, Yardley, but I find there's great irony in the fact that that instrument, which has provided you with quite a career and an impressive resume through the years, is something that, as a youngster, people gave you a hard time about.
Yes, indeed. I like to say now, you know, it really was actually, it was pretty painful, I think, as anything is when kids tease you relentlessly about something. I do like to say now, who has the last laugh, right? But it also contributed to, I think, when I got the audition for The Simpsons, I didn't have a voiceover agent. It went through my regular theatrical agent, which is pretty unusual, like Nancy Cartwright, for instance, who does the voice of Bart and Nelson and Ralph Wiggum. She had always done voiceover. Like, she went to UCLA and studied voiceover. So for me to come by that job through just a regular theatrical agent wasn't that common. And I just honestly never thought that my voice could be an asset because people had made so much fun of it.
Now, before The Simpsons, though, and we have to talk about this, among other things, you worked with our friend Stephen King on Maximum Overdrive.
I love him.
What was that experience like?
You know, I really, I actually remember the audition. I auditioned in New York because I was living in New York City at the time. I live in Los Angeles now, and I have for the last, oh, I think it was about 1987. So that's roughly 100 years. but prior to that, when I first started out as a professional actress, I spent 1 year in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, and then I moved to New York. And I remember going into this huge conference room in one of the high rises in New York City for my callback, and Stephen King was there. And he was so nice. I was so nervous. But he was so gracious and he was so lovely, but also he didn't give a lot away. So I remember thinking, oh, well, I guess I didn't get that job. Oh, well, which I always took really hard. You know, I don't ever go to an audition and sort of half-ass it. I go wanting that job. So I was thrilled when I got it. And then I thought, oh, my God, it's a Stephen King movie and he's directing. This is going to be awesome. It's going to make me a star. And then, of course, it was a total bomb when it came out. Huge bomb. And then because of cable was sort of making its way, right? Because this would have been 1985. Cable had just come on the scene and they didn't have anything. So they ran three of my first movies ad nauseum just because they didn't have stuff. And now it's this great cult classic. But I remember the shoot. It was in North Carolina. Are you rated G? What's your rating?
Well, you know, we're recording this, so we can always edit things out later on or make a strange sound effect.
I sort of cussed like a sailor. I was going to say it was fucking hot that summer, let me tell you. It was as only the Carolinas can be. And having grown up in D.C., I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this humidity and this heat. And so that was brutal. They built the truck stop where we spend most of the movie. It was dusty. And Stephen, I think he says in his, I read his memoir, which I remember really enjoying. But he says in his memoir that that was sort of the height of his alcoholism when he was directing this film. And I didn't know that. I mean, he just seemed like a lovely guy who recognized that he was kind of out of his depth, that this was certainly an area that he didn't have a lot of expertise. But sadly, they extra hamstrung him by giving him an all-Italian crew, all-Italian-speaking crew, because our executive producer was Dito De Laurentiis.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So it's, and they didn't speak English. So, you know, look, directing a film is hard enough, but when you can't even communicate with your crew in the same language, so we had a translator Stephen would say something, he would translate it into Italian, they would say something, translate it back. I mean, I think we probably added a week and a half to the schedule in translation alone. But he was so, he was incredibly humble. I do also remember that every day at 5 o'clock, the beer would come out, like cases of beer, right? And it didn't matter if we had a night shoot, and we had a lot of night shoots. So I remember thinking, oh, that's unusual. Well, anyway, all right. You know, I really was just a willing participant. So I enjoyed him enormously. He was the loveliest man, even when he was sort of battling the worst of his demons at that time.
Well, we think a lot of him here, too. So we're glad to hear it went well for you. Let's talk about The Simpsons. You auditioned for Bart.
I did. But, you know, it sort of overstates the importance of that artifact of my career, really. It really has to do with the fact that they always have women do the voices of young boys because our voices don't change. If you think about, we just started recording season 33, which is insane. You'll never say that again, I don't think, in terms of scripted television. Unless it's a soap opera, right? But primetime scripted television. And so we could imagine how many Barts we would have gone through if Nancy Cartwright didn't do the voice of Bart.
Right.
Because he's 10. And, you know, Lisa Simpson is 8. I like to say she's 8. Every time she has a birthday, she turns 8. And we just don't talk about that.
And of course, people may not know, because it spans a couple of generations now, that it was originally part of the Tracy Ullman show.
That's right. We did what we used to call little bumpers. And James L. Brooks, who's still our executive producer, had this idea that he wanted to put a cartoon on before each commercial break. And back then you had, I think you had one less commercial break for an hour-long show than you do now. Same with half-hour shows. And so we told the whole story in about a minute. It might have been a minute and a half. I can't remember. So they would split it up. And I remember the first one was, there wasn't a lot of dialogue. It was Marge singing Rockabye Baby to the kids, which is, of course, is a harrowing bedtime lullaby when you think about the lyrics. You're like, what is that? How are they not going to go to sleep and just have total nightmares?
Down will come baby, cradle and all. What the
hell
is
you're like,
this?
Really? That's a good idea. And of course, the three Simpsons children, all you see are their huge eyes, completely black, and you just see their big eyes blink, 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 blink in terror after she finishes. And Tracy Ullman was only on for 2 seasons, and it was a great show, great sketch comedy. And we were kind of this extra. And so, for instance, we would go in after her rehearsal day, the whole cast rehearsal day. Dan Castellaneta, who plays Homer, was on the Tracy Ullman show, and so is Julie Kavner, who plays Marge. And I would go in with Nancy at the end of their rehearsal day and record in this makeshift, really not at all soundproof recording booth that was they built behind the audience bleachers. And I remember going for the first at least, I don't know, several months, I would show up and the security guard at the stage would be like, and you are? I'm like, dude, seriously, I know I'm only here for a minute or an hour and it's already 5:30, but really? This is ridiculous.
You mentioned Lisa, eternally 8 years old. And I wonder, do you think that's part of this incredible longevity for the show, is that the characters didn't age? They are always perpetually in that time.
I do, actually. I think it is a unique situation where we, as the characters and the show, you know, the geographical location, even though we never say where our Springfield is, that we remain the constant. And that gives us this unique platform from which to comment on everything that's happening in the world. And also, there is what you can do with animation that you can't obviously do with live action, because I'm 56 now. I think I started doing The Simpsons when I was 24. I mean, that's ridiculous. So, I mean, you obviously in real life, we all age. So you have a unique opportunity to freeze time, which I think whether or not you are sort of, you're zen enough to be okay with aging. There is a kind of a great, I don't believe that there is a single person who hasn't once wished, I wish I could just stop time for a moment.
We're talking with Yardley Smith here on Downtown. How do you view Lisa in the Simpsons universe? Is she the soul? Is she the heart of the family?
Yes, you know, she's been called that a lot. It's heavy is the head that wears that crown, I tell you. But the other thing about Lisa, I've learned so much from Lisa Simpson, which I really, really love her. Like, I love her. I love what she stands for. I love her compassion. I love her heart. I love her resilience. And really, most especially, I love her sense of humor. And I honestly feel like the character works best when you can put her on the soapbox, you can have her get the message out for whatever it is, you know, if we're taking a stand on something. But at the end of the day, if you don't also show her laughing her head off at Itchy and Scratchy, then nobody will really, you'll miss so much of the message, because nobody wants to listen to that precocious child for 22 minutes without the humanity, right? You have to fold that into the whole formula of this wonderful little girl.
700 episodes. I'm sure it would be impossible to pick one, but is there, if somebody said to you, we're going to put one episode in a time capsule for future generations, how would you want Lisa to be represented in that?
Oh, gosh. That's a terrible question, Rich.
I know.
My first thought is, well, there's, gosh, I always say I have like a running list of 10, because really when you have 700, it's so hard to choose. But I think my very first thought was, there's a great episode called The Summer of 4'2". And what I love about that, and what I, one of my favorite things that they do with Lisa Simpson, is they take her out of her comfort zone, and then they, and then she has to figure out how she's going to handle that. And it's enormously appealing and really relatable. And in this episode, the Simpsons family goes on a summer vacation. They, for reasons unknown, Flanders says, yes, you can use my cabin by the beach, which we've never seen before or since, I don't think. And Lisa decides she's going to reinvent herself and hang out with the cool kids. And then Bart is jealous that she's actually getting some traction here. Like, she changes her wardrobe and he outs her. And she finds out. And she, when Mar, and it's a great, great scene where they're sitting at the breakfast table in the kitchen and Marge is there and Lisa is not saying anything. And when Marge turns her back, literally just to the sink, Lisa grabs Bart by the shirt and says, I know exactly who you are. And it's a wonderful, I just love seeing those, the other sides. There's so many facets to that great little character when you get to see little glimpses of her that we don't, aren't ordinarily familiar with. There's another great episode called Lisa on Ice, which is about yes, when they're both on a hockey team, opposing right, hockey teams. Again, as we know, Lisa is no athlete. She's terrible at it. And I think prior in that episode, there's a great scene prior to when they're actually, she turns out to be this phenomenal hockey goalie, which is hilarious, where she's playing dodgeball and the dodgeball deflates on her hair points. You just go, oh, dude.
Do you record together as a cast at all, or is it all done individually?
We pre-pandemic, we recorded all together like an old radio play, which is awesome and very rare. You know, for instance, when we did the crossover episode, this is probably 8 years ago now, I think, with Family Guy, because it was, I guess maybe they had suggested, I forget how, but for some reason, we went to their studio to record. All my stuff was with the character Meg, who's Mila Kunis, and I never met her. Like, I did all my stuff by myself. So obviously we're a well-oiled enough machine now where we can do that. But I have to tell you that my preference is always, because I stand between Dan, who does Homer, and Nancy, who does Bart, in our recording studio. First of all, it never gets old, especially to watch somebody like Dan, who does so many voices in any given episode. Watch him go from voice to voice to voice. I could watch it all day. He's so brilliant. Same with Hank, same with Harry. But the way Dan or Nancy or Julie or anybody says a line to Lisa Simpson is going to inform the way I respond. So I miss that when the pandemic hit. We now do our read-throughs, our table reads, which are really the most important part for the writers. It's the very first time they hear the script out loud. It's only once when they hear it all together, just run through. And they see what jokes work, what don't, where the rewrites need to start at least. So we used to do that all together in a conference room. And now we've been doing it over Zoom. And then for a while, we were recording over Zoom. So this setup that you, if your listeners, if you put video up at all on your show as well, this is where I would record Lisa Simpson. But you know, there could be lawnmowers, garbage trucks, barking dogs, you name it. So while it's a pretty darn good setup because I have a co-host a podcast, so I had good equipment, there was so much cleanup on the back end for the engineers that as soon as they said, you can come in now one at a time to record your part, I was like, yes, sign me up, because it just was so much more efficient. So I'm now, for instance, today, I'll go into the studio, record an episode we read about 10 days ago. I'll still be directed over Zoom and the engineer is in a booth like your guy, 10 feet behind me. But it's just, at least it's a little better.
I look at your microphone and I think back on a story many years ago when Stephen did an episode of The Simpsons. I remember he came in to record it here in the station, but the producers had sent him a microphone. He's like, don't they know I own a radio station? My mics aren't good enough for The Simpsons?
That is hilarious.
You
way not to
that?
Do your homework, folks. Yeah, awesome.
I had to help set that up. And they did it because the microphones all have, it's the same mics that you guys used to record with. They all have the sort of the same resonance and sound to them. So it makes it much easier to match everything.
It's funny you say that. There, I learned about reflection. So I was like, what the hell is that? And they said, which is why it's beneficial, even if we go in individually to record, to do it in exactly the same location mm-hmm. with the same equipment, because it makes it all sound like we were all in the same room. It makes it all mm-hmm. sound the same, as opposed to, oh, I'm in this great little room that's a little bar at my house, right? And somebody else is in their closet and somebody else is in their bathroom. And it's quite a bit more complicated than you would think.
Well, we could talk Simpsons all day because we're both big Simpsons fans. But Carrie and I both struck by this when we talked about having you on the show. We both talked about this show, and I have had at least half a dozen people in the last couple of days when I've said, hey, we're going to be talking to Yardley Smith. They said, oh, my God, please ask her about Herman's Head.
Oh, such a great, great show. So fun. Sadly, only three seasons. It was on like, I think this, it was like 89, was it going to be 89 or 90, 91, 92, somewhere in there. And I played a character named Louise, who was sort of Herman's best friend and worked with him in the office as opposed to being in his brain. There were four actors who played various aspects of his brain. So there was Genius, Angel, who was his emotions, Animal, who was his lust and sort of sex drive, and who was Fear? A guy, oh crap, I might remember later. And then there was the Fear, right? And so, but I was in the office And it was so much. And Hank Azaria was also on that show.
Yeah.
We were both. So The Simpsons had just gone to half hour. I think it was 1990, because I remember being on two shows on the same night on the same network, separated by 1 hour. And I was like, does life get better than this? I don't think so. I was never happier.
That was great. And I was ahead of its time.
It was. It was. After that, there was a much more sort of, because we were network shows, so we were very PG. There was a Showtime version of basically the same premise that was ran a little... started a little bit after us, but it's basically the same thing. And it's a great idea. You know, everybody wants to know what somebody is thinking. And when you look at them, like, I know you're thinking something. What could it be?
And then there I was the other night surfing the dial and what should come up. But one of my favorite movies that I hadn't seen in forever, As Good As It Gets.
Oh, so great. It's funny. You know what's funny about that? So that was directed by James L. Brooks, who is our executive producer on The Simpsons.
Right.
And people are like, oh, well, Yardley, that's a given. I mean, you're on The Simpsons, and of course he put you in this movie. And I am so grateful to have been in that movie, but I'm telling you, I'd already worked on The Simpsons, I think, for 15 years when he was like, you know what, you should come be in my movie. I'm like, if I had to wait 15 years every time somebody who's like, that's a good idea, good God. But that was, you know, I haven't done a lot of movies that are that successful. And it's just next level. You can feel it when you're shooting it. It is just a really incredibly well-oiled machine. It is, you just feel it. And I was so honored. I was so delighted. That was fun.
How are the Simpsons producers, are they, I guess, protective is the word I would use, of these voice talents?
They're protective of the characters. You know, I would say the funny thing is that most of our writing staff is male. They've done a slightly better job now introducing it. I think there's maybe four women on staff now, but literally for decades, it was all men and one woman, this great female writer named Carolyn Omine, who's written some classics. And what they have told me is that Lisa Simpson is them. Like, the writers are getting all of their childhood angst out through Lisa Simpson. And if you think about it, it sort of makes sense, because they were always the smartest people in the room when they were at school. They all, you know, went to Harvard or all these Ivy League schools. And like Al Jean, who's one of our showrunners, he went to Harvard for physics when he was like 15 or something. Right. I mean, the dude is legit genius, right? I know, because when I did drama in school, when I did school plays, and that was really all I did, and I really excelled at it.
You're talking to a high school drama director right here.
Oh, it's, well, then you know that when you have somebody who stands out, it's great for the production, but it can also be challenging socially, right?
Oh yeah.
But it's the same with if you're great at sports, if you're a math whiz, whatever it is that sets you apart from your peer group can make you feel like, oh, I don't really fit in. Now I'm different, when all you want to do is fit in. So I think it was the same for all these male writers, even though, so they're writing out all of, they're doing their therapy through Lisa Simpson.
Who is it among the cast when you are recording all together? Who's the one cast member who's likely to get you to crack more easily than others?
Oh, Dan Castellaneta or Hank Azaria. Hank, actually, he lives in New York now, so he doesn't actually record with us. They'll schedule his recording. He prefers to do it on his own. He does a lot of riffing. He's phenomenal. So I stand next to Dan, and honest to God, like I said, it never gets old. And Dan, when he ad-libs as Homer, or really any of his characters, Groundskeeper Willie, who else does he do? I'm drawing a blank now. He does about 25 regular characters. Dan is a genius. I can never get enough of Dan.
All right, we mentioned this for anybody who's not familiar. Can you tell people about your podcast, Small Town Dicks?
Yes.
Which is not pornographic at all.
Well, Rich, I'm hoping that you'll support me in knowing that Dix used to be noir slang for detective.
Absolutely.
So that was sort of what we were hanging our hat on. But the funny thing is, so I co-host this really wonderful, very, I feel like very reverent, respectful towards the victims, true crime podcast with two identical twin detectives, Dan and Dave. And all of our cases are told by, so Dan and Dave always tell a couple of stories, cases that they investigated in each season. But then we have other guests, and it's always the detective who investigated that case. So you get really a very granular look at how an investigation needs to go in order for justice to be served for these victims. In addition, Dan and Dave really felt strongly that we change all the names of our victims, and as well as suspects, actually. We don't tell you where the crime took place, and we only use the first names of our detectives. And it really is just because, and all of our cases are adjudicated as well. We just don't want to put anybody through it all over again. And for us, what's interesting and what the podcast really focuses on is if you're only going to get 10% of the outcome of a case on the news or in the newspaper, what is below that 10%? What are all of the things that needed to go exactly right in order for these dominoes to line up in order for justice to be served? And it's really, really good.
I have to think it's a lot of fun, too, just to work a different muscle in doing this and look at it more as a storyteller.
It's really well said. The role that I play on my side of the table is I'm you. So if you had the privilege to have a seat at that table, what are the questions that you might ask? And it's anything. I'm not afraid to say, like, what is that acronym mean? Or there's an episode that drops tomorrow where I say, I think I've asked this question 10 times, but why is it hearsay when you have an actual recording from one of the witnesses? Why is that hearsay? It's that person. And you find out that every accuser has a right to question somebody that is accusing them, right? So I just ask it all. But the other piece I want to know is, if you are one of those people who is willing to go toward the things that the rest of us run from, if you are one of those people who sees the worst of humanity every single day, that's your job. Where does that live inside of you? Where do you put it? How do you be a father? How do you be a husband? How do you be a friend? Where does it go? And they all say, you just put it in a box. The problem is that the lock on that box isn't that good.
Right, right. Well, I listened to a couple episodes, and it's terrific. I also had the chance to watch a couple of episodes of Oil and Water, and I don't know, you're telling me Twinkies and onions worked together.
Listen to me. It's alchemy. That one actually worked out. So yeah, I'm actually a pretty good cook, even though I don't cook a lot of very good things on my silly cooking show. But during the pandemic, I was like, you know, and I don't get asked to do a lot of acting roles anymore. I don't know why. Business has changed a lot and whatever. And I have a production company, and we produce a lot of things, but we not necessarily for me. In any case, I was like, you know what? I think I would like to do a funny, silly cooking show. And it really all started because I had decided I would make a recipe from The Simpsons, from one of the Tracy Ullman shorts, where Homer makes Bart dinner, and he combines basically fish and pork, and he makes porkified fish nuggets. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to make that and see. And it turns out to be not terrible, which on Oil and Water is high praise. So I came up with this idea that I would take actually create a game. It's really more of a game than a cooking show. Each episode is about 6 or 8 minutes long. You can find it on Instagram at Oil and Water Food and on YouTube at Oil and Water Food. So the premise is I draw one random sweet ingredient, one random savory ingredient, and then one random thing, like it's a pie, it's a soup, it's an ice cream, it's a you name it. And then I have to make it on the fly. So that's what I do. And yes, I drew my sweet thing was Twinkies, my savory thing was onions, and my thing was a dumpling. So I made a Twinkie onion dumpling. And I tell you, Rich, you would not be mad about it.
And what was it that you combined with beef sticks?
Oh, So that was our Easter episode, and I was thrilled to have Detective Dan from yes. Small Town Dicks as my celebrity chef on Oil and Water. He also happens to be my fiance, so that was easy. Dan is not a great cook, but Dan got to pick the ingredients. And so he chose beef sticks. I'm like, you brought me gas station food? What? Like Slim Jims, right?
Yeah.
Horrible. I've never had one of those in my life. And he brought me those little marshmallow peeps.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm like, this is going to be. And then I thought, okay, my only hope is my thing was a casserole. So that part was random. And I'm like, all right, we're going to make basically like a Thanksgiving casserole, sweet potatoes. We're going to put the beef sticks on the bottom and the peeps on the top, and we're going to roast it. Oh my God, it was bad. It's so funny. It's so, so funny. So I loved that he was willing to come on and do the show.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to visit with you today. We appreciate you making some time for us, and I hope we can do it again down the road.
I hope so, too. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
Oh,
what a pleasure.
We'll hope we get to do it again. Thanks, Yardley.
I hope so, too. I just want to tell you that, you know, when I wrote to you, I said I love Maine. So my brother lived in Friendship, Maine.
Oh, really?
For about, 25 years.
Oh, that's a beautiful area.
Yeah. And he worked for the Department of Environmental Protection down in Bangor, actually.
That's where we are. We're based in Bangor.
And he lives in the UK doing what he used to do for the Department of Environmental Protection. And then we both went to camp in Maine when we were kids. So Thomas went to Chewonky.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to Alford Lake.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wow.
And Thomas was a counselor at Chewonky. And so I love Maine. It's just one of the most beautiful places in the whole world.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, when we get through all this foolishness and you're able to travel again, if you're here
I'll
in the area.
Come into the studio.
Yeah, stop in and say hello. We'd love that.
I'd love it too.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Yardley.
You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
Oh,
what
we
a
do
pleasure.
Too. We'll hope we get to do it again. Thanks, Yardley.
I hope so too.